This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, a Christmas wish list of some of your favorite events in Cape Breton this time of year. You'll hear about the Two Rivers Wildlife Park Winter Light-Up Trail, an intimate Christmas concert featuring some of the best local musicians, and Santa Claus is coming to Whitney Pier. Also on the show this week, some financial advice on how to enjoy the holidays without breaking the bank, and the province's Liberal leader stopped by the Coast newsroom during his recent visit to the island.
One of the favorite songs they love to hear during the winter at the Two Rivers Wildlife Park is Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow. But not too much, just enough to make it festive for the winter light-up. We'd like to welcome to the program Linda. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you very much for having me.
It's going to be exciting, the light-up. You know what? I know you've been having it for the last number of years, and I've been meaning to get out there, and I think this is going to be on my bucket list this year, and hoping many other Cape Bretoners get out to check out the light-up. Tell us a bit about it.
This is going to be our 11th year. It's a walk through the woods. It's a little less than a kilometer, but almost there. We added a new section this year. And you can walk through, you can see we have Charlie Brown characters, we have Candyland, Whoville, Sesame Street, we've got characters from Looney Tunes, there's little cabins that you can walk through. It's just a really great time.
So can you see it from space? All lit up?
I imagine you can at this point, there's that many lights.
Really? So do you ever actually count them? How many lights do you put into the display?
We haven't. It's something we've talked about, but at this point there is that many, it would be almost impossible. We have just totes and totes and totes of lights, just more than you can ever imagine.
Reason why I asked that, I'm thinking this would be a great contest. Guess how many lights are in the winter light-up trail and win a prize. Wouldn't that be cool?
Oh, that would be fun. We'll have to think about that for next year.
There you go. So to put that out there for you. So it's coming up on December 16th. You know, people are busy around Christmas time, but still in the festive mood. So if they want to drop by after Christmas, they can check it out as well, right?
That's correct. We run from the 16th right through to the 23rd every single evening, and the 27th to the 30th.
Now, if folks are looking to get a ticket, do they have to pre-purchase them or do you get them at the gate? How does that work?
You have to pre-purchase tickets just because we don't want to overcrowd anyone. So they can be purchased by phone at the park or you can stop out. It's $15 a person and two and under is free. For the $15, you get the walk through the trail, you get a hot dog, Santa Claus is at the end to give the kids a cookie, there's hot chocolate, and you get a tractor and wagon ride down to the trail and back up to your car.
How cool is that? And just like you did with the Halloween displays, I see you have it staggered. 5 o'clock is the first one, then 6 o'clock and 7 o'clock, right?
Yes, that gives everybody a chance to take their time and stroll through it and really take everything in and enjoy it.
So would you suggest maybe showing up a little bit earlier just to make sure that you get everything ready to go to get on time for 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, depending when you're going?
Absolutely. It would be a great idea.
All right. So once again, it's 727-2483, as you heard Linda saying. You have to pre-purchase your ticket. This sounds like a lot of fun and looking forward to seeing the Santa and all your friends and neighbors. They're going to be there. And it's so cool to get into the festive spirit. And this is another big fundraiser for the gang at the Two Rivers Wildlife Park as well, which helps feed the animals, right?
Absolutely. And we're still cleaning up from Fiona. So the funds are more important this year than ever as well.
Okay, once again, it's 727-2483. You're probably going to see me this year, Linda. I'm looking forward to it. It's the winter light-up at the Two Rivers Wildlife Park. And if you want to get more, give them a call, as mentioned on that number. You can also check out their Facebook page as well. We'll chat soon, and we'll see you at around Christmas time.
I look forward to seeing you all there.
Countdown to Christmas is on, and the busiest shopping season is well underway. Even though people are worried about inflation and other financial challenges, surveys are showing consumers are prepared to spend to make the holidays merry. BDO Senior Vice President Paul Moffitt talks with Dave DeVoe.
So, Paul, since the last time we've talked, it looks obvious that inflation, cost of living problems have gotten worse. I guess I'll just start off by just asking you what you think in the face of all this, and your sort of basic summary advice to consumers.
Sure thing. Thanks, Dave. There's been several polls conducted as of late, and while it shows that some Canadians are looking for ways to reduce their costs this year, the bottom line is that consumers appear ready to spend this year for Christmas. And that's despite inflation and the rising interest rates and the fact that people are finding it harder to save money. But the one particular survey shows us that the average, you know, planned spend this year is for about $790. Another one shows that about one third of people are planning on spending more. Another one third are planning to spend less, and I assume the remaining one third are planning on spending about the same. Another concerning one, though, from another one shows that Canadians are expecting to spend somewhere around $600, which is, again, about the same as what that particular survey showed last year from the CPA Canada. What is concerning about that particular survey is that about two-thirds of people are saying that they have not saved money for the year. And despite that, of those two-thirds that did not send about half of them still plan to spend the same as they did last year.
And this is with a recession likely coming.
Yeah, and so with a recession looming and high interest rates and inflation and all the other warning signs that we're seeing, that's very concerning. And on top of that, about a quarter of people say that they're likely to take on debt just to cover the holiday costs. So, you know, and on top of that, then we've got, like we said, we talked about inflation. There's going to be, you know, people can expect some sticker shock when they go to the stores for anything from clothing to electronics to books to toys. And then lastly, if you're planning on hosting any kind of a meal, food prices are soaring. And we're seeing food costs increase at the fastest rate in more than four decades. So whatever that festive feast is, it's going to cost more this year. So, you know, staying on top of your finances gets even more difficult during the holidays, of course, because everywhere you look, there are messages that are urging you to spend. And we know from past years that approximately one in five people will experience what we call the debt regret over what they've spent for the holidays. So how do you ensure that you're not paying more for the holidays long after they're over? Well, Dave, I can't stress enough that the importance... I can't stress enough the importance of a holiday spending budget. You need to really sit down and determine what you really can afford and create a budget and stick to it. And when doing so, be sure to include everything. So it's not just gifts. It's decoration. It's travel. It's groceries. It's meals. It's all of that stuff. So it's really important to remember everything.
Yeah, and of course... easier said than done, I think we both must concede, because of the temptation that you referenced, right? And not just the temptation, but I mean, look, most people have some degree of holiday traditions to which they adhere. Families get together, you know, I mean, it's really hard to make a budget at this time of year, of all times of year.
Yes, that actually brings me to another point that I really wanted to talk about today, is that budgeting for Christmas, I mean, it's too late to talk about this now, unfortunately, but budgeting for Christmas really should start in January. So, you know, one tip that I generally give when I talk about, you know, getting ready for Christmas is start in January. Figure out what you think you're going to spend in the following, you know, in 12 months from then. Take that number, divide it by 10, and deposit that much into a different savings account every single month for the first 10 months of the year. So then when you get to the end of October, you've saved for 10 months, and then for November and December, you can spend that much. And so, you know, it's really important to stick to that budget. You know, a few other tricks is that you can avoid using a credit card by using a debit card instead. If you do need to use a credit card, you know, a great solution is to use a prepaid credit card. Because a prepaid credit card has a limit. You put so much on it, and that's all you can spend. And so it's a great way that will get you to, you know, to possibly put some limits on what you're planning on spending. There's reward points, loyalty points that can help for a lot of holiday expenses as well. But it really comes down to planning. Make sure you have a clear idea of what you're looking for. Get out there early. Give yourself as much time as you can so that you can make sure that you're looking for the best deals and that you're not shopping at the last minute. Because if you're shopping at the last minute, you're going to be impulsive, and you're more than likely going to overspend. And the last one, I guess, is just avoid online shopping if you can. One, it's better for the local economy, but two, just, you know, websites out there are so designed to get you to spend and to do it with the click of a mouse and quickly, and that can lead to regret.
Yeah, and of course, I don't know about in your area, but around this area, there have been many campaigns talking about shop local, support local. So, the holidays, what better time to do that, right?
Absolutely. I think that's a fantastic idea. We need to be supporting our local economies.
Now, we both know, sadly, there are going to be some people who do come out of the Christmas season or their holiday season with some debt. So with that condition sort of in the past tense, what advice would you have for those people that are just going to be dealing with that?
Well, it depends on how what kind of a situation you're in. There's a few tips and tricks when it comes time to, if you've racked up a bunch of debt over Christmas time and come next January, February, like, what are you going to do with that? Again, look at your budget and adjust where you can to free up some funds so that you can put that money towards paying down that debt. There are different solutions. It depends on your personality and what you're feeling, what you feel is going to be the best fit for you. One option is to take the smallest credit card and just pay it off as quickly as you can. And then that just gives you that feeling of achievement that you've got that one card paid off and that you're making progress. Another one would be to take the highest interest card and chip away at that so that the other cards that you're ignoring for the moment, they accumulate less interest than that one that's at the highest interest rate. Contact your credit card about lowering your interest rates if you can, or talk about, consolidating debt. If none of those work and you truly do need help, then call a professional, at BDO. That's what we do. We are here to help with people who've got overwhelming debt, and there's lots of tips and tricks on our own website, bdodebt.ca, or you can call us at 855-BDO-DEBT, and we'd be happy to talk to you about different solutions that you have. Because it's important not to lose hope. If you've got overwhelming debt, it's really easy to lose hope, to feel like you're alone. But it's important that you remember, you are not the only one. I see people every day, and so that's evidence in itself that you are not the only one, and it's, you should not feel embarrassed or ashamed or defeated, but that you should remain hopeful and that there's always a solution. And that's my job. That's what I do. I help people find solutions. So if you can't deal with that debt, then reach out to us, because that's what we do and that's what we're here to help for.
All right. Well, on that optimistic note, is there anything else you'd like to add, Paul?
The last thing I wanted to say, Dave, is to all of your listeners out there, I hope that you all have a safe and happy and financially stress-free holiday.
Okay. And same to you, my friend. And I look forward to our conversation. I know we'll have occasion to speak again soon.
Thank you very much. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We all know that December is a very busy month for the big guy. Of course, we're talking about Santa Claus who's coming to town to Whitney Pier for the Whitney Pier Community Christmas Party coming up on Saturday, December 10th at the Pier Legion. And with us from the Whitney Pier Group, Alan Atherson. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill. Always good to speak to you.
Looking forward to seeing Santa Claus coming up on December 10th. And not just a visit with Santa. You've got a lot of stuff going on that day.
We do. 1 to 1:30, we have a magic show. At 1:30, Santa arrives for pictures and a visit. And 1:30 to 3, we have a face painter, balloon twister. We've got a coloring contest happening with $20 gift cards to 10 different winners. And as a door prize, we decided, I found these 11-foot-high inflatable Santas.
That's cool. And,
oh, yeah. So there's a free ballot at the door to whoever walks in, and we have five. Did I say they're 11 foot high?
You did say they're 11 feet high, yes.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really cool.
Imagine some kid winning this and putting it in their bedroom.
And not only that, going on with this community Christmas party, you've got free pizza and free cookies for the kids as well, right?
Right. So kids can get a free slice of pizza. We have Christmas cookies and cake. We have hot chocolate. We have apple juice. So the kids will do well. And on top of that, when they leave, the roommate made 300 treat bags to pass out to the kids as they go home.
This sounds like a fun day for the kids. It brings me back to the olden days when we used to go to the Legion, I remember, in Sydney Mines, and Santa would show up and all the kids would get a bag of candy. So looking forward to it. Coming up on December the 10th between 1 and 3 o'clock, and you want to get there early with your kids because it's one of those events that with all this free stuff, you know that you're going to run out. So make sure that you get there early.
Santa says free is good. Bill, everyone in the CBRM are welcome to join us.
Beautiful. That's coming up on Saturday, December 10th. We're looking forward to it. It is the Whitney Pier Community Christmas Party at the Pier Legion. Thanks for this, Alan.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Liberal leader Zach Churchill tells Dave DeVoe from the Coast Newsroom the provincial government has made challenging situations even more difficult. Churchill was in Cape Breton to talk to some residents and businesses about the damage caused by Fiona, but his conversation with DeVoe quickly changed to healthcare.
Okay, so Zach, you're back in Cape Breton. What brings you back on this occasion?
Dave, nice to be here with you again. Listen, we're spending a lot of time on the island, following up with some of the folks we met with during Hurricane Fiona to see how things are going. We've met with a whole bunch of organizations, actually, Horizons, Navigate, here in Sydney, who are doing really, really interesting things from a social enterprise perspective, from an economic development and innovation perspective, and of course, talking to folks about the state of healthcare on the island and being brought up to speed about the situation here.
Now, you put out a press release recently talking about the Houston government not doing enough, in your view, to deal with the challenges in emergency rooms. And you know, of course, they've been doing all kinds of initiatives, whether it's virtual care or mobile clinics. They've been spending, what is it, $11 million bringing in travel nurses. They're setting up a new mental health day clinic here, all kinds of initiatives going on. So what could they be doing that they aren't to deal with the issue?
Well, they're making decisions that are making the situation worse in our emergency room. You know, from the way that they deal with public health and infectious disease, that's creating a major pressure on our emergency rooms. The fact that we're looking at travel nurses at a time when every single province is trying to maintain their labor force. We have labor shortages in every single province. You know, we're spending twice as much on travel nurses. It might make more sense to actually look at a better retention strategy to keep our nurses here and maybe pay them more.
Because now, they did just announce a a new recruitment strategy. They've hired a number of new doctors, including one here in the Eastern Zone. So, I mean, it's and that's just one of, well, of recruitment and retention. So that's well underway.
Let's look at the stats. You know, we have nearly twice as many people without a family doctor here in Nova Scotia. They inherited Anita a doctor waitlist that was at 70,000 people. At that time, they said it was an absolute crisis in primary care. We are now over 120,000 people without a family doctor. We had a very good family doctor incentive program that they cut. We saw the numbers shoot up right after that happened as well. We have a worse situation in our hospitals. We're over capacity in every single region across the province. We have less coverage with paramedics and ambulances, and a much more dire situation from one end of the province to the other. People are waiting longer for surgeries. They're waiting longer for CAT scans and preventative care that is so critical to saving lives and taking resource pressure off the system. And of course, the situation is very challenging in healthcare, but they've made decisions that have actually, you know, made it worse. They fired a group of professionals on the health authority board to put in, you know, their partisan allies. We've seen the management of the healthcare system slip as a result of that. You know, they ran marketing campaigns telling everyone to get back out there last year when we were in the midst of the Omicron wave of the pandemic. The healthcare system still hasn't recovered from that. They've removed public health information from the public. When it comes to the impact that infectious disease is having on our hospitals and the overcrowding situation. And these things matter. It impacts healthcare outcomes from one end of the province to the other. So we've yet to see, by any measurable standard, the situation in improving healthcare. And again, it's a challenging situation everywhere, all over the country. But they have certainly made some decisions that have taken a challenging situation and made it worse here in Nova Scotia.
How much?
And again, a lot of those initiatives that started under the previous government. So they, on one hand, they say, you know, that the Liberal government didn't do anything for 8 years. And then on the other hand, they take credit for a number of the initiatives that we actually move forward with, like virtual care, like the infrastructure spending that was happening here on Cape Breton Island and, of course, on the mainland as well.
But they've announced initiatives of their own, like the ones I've mentioned before. They're the recruitment initiative, the mental health day hospital. I mean, say what you want about travel nurses, but I mean, we need, you know, there's an immediate need to fill labor gaps. So I mean, they're doing something.
Well, I mean, they're doing the same thing that was done previously. So, you know, a mobile truck moving from community to community is going to have, you know, less of an impact on healthcare than expanding the scope of practice for paramedics would have, or pharmacists would have, for example. You know, we really have to be looking at less PR initiatives and announcements and actually making some real systemic changes in the system that are going to improve access to healthcare. Primary care being, you know, the chief, I think, concern among many Nova Scotians right now.
One of the things I'm hearing from progressive conservatives and some other commentators is talk about the extent to which this is a matter of investment and a matter versus to the extent to which it's a matter of logistics. What do you think about that? Is it primarily a money issue, or as Mr. Houston and others have suggested, is it really in large part about logistics and just changing the way things are done and making them more efficient, which might cost a bit of money, but you know not as significant as some of the bigger investments one might make?
It's more than either one of those things. You know, we need to rethink the system of healthcare here in Nova Scotia. It's bursting at the seams right now. It is getting worse, no matter whether you're looking at access to primary care and people who need a family doctor. Those numbers have shot up here on Cape Breton. They've shot up for the first time over the last year in the capital region, in Halifax. That never happened over the last 10 years. Did we see that start? That started happening in Halifax now. We have to really rethink some things, and access to primary care is one of those things that we have to rethink. You know, we have, and I learned this during the overseeing the immunization rollout here in Nova Scotia. We had one of the most equitable distributions of vaccines in the whole country because we used pharmacies primarily and public health facilities as well and clinics, but we really leaned on our pharmacists and our pharmacies. And we got to nearly everywhere in the province. Even some of the smallest, most remote communities had very close points of access for vaccines because we leaned on our pharmacists. They can do a lot more when it comes to prescription renewals, when it comes to ordering lab work and blood tests. And we are not utilizing them to their full scope of practice. And as a result, Nova Scotians without a family doctor who are either struggling with virtual care or are unable to access that as well are forced to go to our emergency rooms to do things like get a prescription renewal or get, you know, a requisition form done for their blood work. These are not emergency matters, but people are being forced to go into our emergency rooms where people are sick, where right now it's actually, you know, quite problematic because there's as one doctor said, we have an epidemic here in Nova Scotia of influenza A right now, along with COVID that's still spreading, and RSV, which is primarily affecting kids. But we have all these respiratory viruses that are sitting in our emergency rooms now, and people that aren't able to get their prescriptions renewed are forced to go into that situation. And we really need to rethink that model of delivery and make sure that we're creating new access points for primary care so people don't have to do that. And so less strain is being put on our emergency rooms.
Do you think the government is not already kind of receptive to that line of thought? Not, I mean, you made particular suggestions there, but more generally, if I recall correctly, the deputy, I think it was the Deputy Health Minister Jeanine Lagasse at the recent Health Committee meeting said just what you said, that we have to rethink the way we do healthcare. And you know, she outlined various things that were going on, changing different restrictions with regard to paramedics and things like that. I mean, are they not already on the same wavelength?
Well, Jeanine was Deputy Minister or Associate Deputy Minister when we were in government as well. She served 8 years, either in executive council or in the health department when we were in government. So she's speaking to a lot of the initiatives that actually began, you know, before this government took office. So expansion of the scope of practice for paramedics and pharmacists, you know, did begin a number of years ago.
But she's speaking as if though that general philosophy is continuing, though.
Well, it needs to, but it needs to be expedited. It needs to move more quickly because our healthcare system right now is really bursting at the seams, and people are not able to access, in some cases, life-saving preventative care. In other cases, more rarely, thankfully, you know, life-saving surgeries. You know, and these things need to happen very, very quickly. And I do think, you know, the conservative government is very focused on kind of the PR around healthcare, but we need them to focus more on executing on policy change and reform as quickly as possible, or the healthcare system is going to continue to drown in the pressure that it's experiencing right now.
Just to stick with the healthcare related topic, as I'm sure you're aware, there's a lot of anxiety over the state of the pandemic with regard to schools and how it's being picked up there. There's talk about whether we should or shouldn't have a mask mandate, various debates and anxieties among parents. The government says it's following the advice of public health and not having a mask mandate in schools. Where do you stand on that?
Well, we're getting mixed messages. You know, we've had Dr. Link, who is the chief pediatrician at the IWK, a wonderful doctor, very well respected, you know, coming out and saying we have to do something right now because the IWK is being overwhelmed. They can't respond to emergency situations that are coming into their emergency room. And the big pressure is the respiratory illnesses that are spreading very quickly across the province. And he suggested that we do have to look at wearing masks more. We've not heard that, you know, from the government.
He didn't come right out and say mandate, though, did he?
No, and that's not something that I'm advocating for either. But I think, you know, when you have a government that is running promotional advertisements saying, get back out there, everything's safe, the pandemic's over, at a time when respiratory illnesses are ravaging our hospitals and making more and more people sick. Over now, 82% of the people that have died from COVID have been over the last year. You know, when you're running marketing ads telling everybody it's safe, get back out there, don't worry about it, at a time when these respiratory illnesses are having the worst impact yet on people's health and on the hospital system, that's a big problem. And when Nova Scotians have gotten very used to kind of taking the lead from the premier and the government on these things, right? Because they followed Stephen McNeil's lead. They did follow Ian Rankin's lead when we were bringing in restrictions. We're, of course, not in a situation now where restrictions are going to be tolerated. It's more of an information campaign, I think, that the public needs to know the state of everything. But the public is very used to taking the lead from the premier. When the premier is not talking about the respiratory illnesses, when they've removed the weekly information that was going out to people and only producing that once a month, and when they're running marketing campaigns telling everybody, hey, get out there and have fun, when this is, you know, still a major problem that's affecting, people's health and operations in the hospital, I think that's a big problem.
I wonder if these mixed message, you're calling them, with regard to the marketing campaign on the one hand and the state of the pandemic on the other, is just a matter of having to balance the need to spur economic recovery from the pandemic on the one hand to continue managing its effects prudently on the other. I mean, isn't it just about striking that balance rather than mixed messages? Maybe there's a bit of tension there between those two priorities, but they both have to be undertaken. So how would you strike that balance differently as an aspiring premier?
Well, our economy fared really well because we had a government in place previously that knew that good public health measures meant the economic recovery would happen more quickly. So we've actually been on a very strong economic footing. Not to say a lot of people have not struggled. Small businesses in particular, retail, restaurants certainly struggled through the pandemic period, but the recovery has been very strong in Nova Scotia organically. You know, we've had population growth during the last number of years. Even throughout rural Nova Scotia, we're seeing the population go up. We're seeing the real estate market increase in value, and that still hasn't really slowed down, to this date. So there has been kind of very strong economic footing here and a very strong economic recovery. And that has been precisely because the public has felt safe and that we've looked after each other, during this period. So I think, to have a government then pushing messaging that's probably counter to good public health advice probably isn't the right thing to do from a health perspective or an economic perspective, you know.
Is there not a legitimate worry, though, that if the messaging from the government is too dire, that it might discourage consumption and thereby hurt the economic recovery?
Well, I mean, I think with interest rates going up through the central banks, there is an effort by, the financial sector to curb inflation and to curb household spending. So, I mean, those big fiscal measures are going to have more of an impact than a social media marketing campaign, I think, on the economy and on people's
spending. But at the same time, even during a recession or an anticipated recession, we still have to recover from the pandemic regardless of...
We need a strategy heading into a recession, right? So we are faced down with a recessionary environment here, and having a public marketing campaign that is against the advice of public health, I don't think is the answer to doing that. You know, we need a real strategy from this government on what they're going to do with the economy, how they're going to navigate these choppy waters, because a lot of things are changing, right? It's not just consumer spending. We've got a labor shortage. That's the biggest issue we have in our economy right now, right? And, you can tell people to get out there and spend money all you want. If Tim Hortons and Reitmans and Zellers and Sobeys can't find the staff to work the stores, we're going to see what's happening now, and that's places being closed down and not being able to open up, and that impacts the economy, right? So what is
the
strategy?
Couldn't it be worse, though, I'm saying? If the government's public health message is too dire, couldn't it just add to those pressures and hurt the economy even more?
This government ran on a commitment to fix healthcare, right? And we've seen the healthcare situation deteriorate very drastically under their stewardship. Almost twice as many people without a family doctor in the last year alone. We've never seen that number shoot up that much. We've never seen our hospitals get overwhelmed or be understaffed like they are now. So their primary raison d'etre, the reason that they were elected, their primary promise to Nova Scotians was to fix healthcare, right? So you would think that they'd be taking measures to improve the situation in our hospitals that are tangible and that are actually creating a meaningful difference so that our healthcare workers, you know, aren't being overwhelmed every day, so people are able to access the care that they need. Now, the promises that they made on the economy, they haven't moved forward on either. You know, they promised everybody a better paycheck, right? They promised that employers would get a major tax benefit, and so long as all those dollars that they recouped would go back to their workers. You know, we're in an inflationary environment right now. The cost of living has shot up, and I don't know. They have not even moved on that commitment to give everybody a better paycheck guarantee. And again, that was promised on day one of his government. He said that in, I think, all three debates. The other thing they promised for their economic plan was the Nova Scotia Loyal Program, you know, where people would be incentivized to buy locally through a point system. They haven't come close to even beginning to implement that either. So their two big economic promises, we are also seeing them not come through on. And more than that, they're also taking over all the economic development agencies and the venture capital organizations, like InnovaCorp. So they are, like they did in healthcare, getting rid of professional boards that were being run by experts, and putting, as the premier said himself, his friends in charge of these things. That's a very dangerous thing to do when you're heading into a recession, right? We have not seen an economic plan articulated by this government, right? And I'm sorry, but running a get back out there social media marketing campaign just isn't going to cut it, right? With the choppy economic situation that we're facing, you know, they've taken over all the professional organizations that help drive investment and innovation in our economy, and they're putting partisans and allies at the heads of these organizations and getting rid of independent boards.
He says it makes them more accountable, right? I mean, arm's length organizations, at least he's calling the shots now. So whether you'd like or dislike what he's going to do, he's more accountable.
Well, sure, but do you really want politicians calling the shots on venture capital? You know, that's a really...
Well, they don't do it directly, though. Like a politician doesn't directly make that call. They'll obviously consult experts. His argument is it's just making him.
But he fired all the experts and the boards, right? So you had people on these, on like, let's look at the InnovaCorp board, for example. People, you know, you had an executive from Google. You have innovation leaders that aren't just leaders here in the province, but like globally, directing big sums of public dollars into research and innovation, right? That is not an easy field to make decisions in, right? So you want people that understand technology, that understand where the economy's going, where the market's going, and can make these strategic investments smartly. And Malcolm Fraser, who is the CEO of InnovaCorp, was really good at that. And he got like a 375% return on, you know, one of his key investments. So they've gotten rid of all those people, including Malcolm Fraser. They put in someone who the premier's called his friend, and they have put the ministers in charge of directing where these dollars are going. So I know this for a fact. You know, I've been a minister. I served for 8 years. I don't know any political leader that is better at directing venture capital than a board full of experts that include people from Google and high tech firms, right? And who are big investors in their own right.
But he'll still consult experts. I mean, as you know, having headed several departments regularly consult experts, even if they don't have formal roles given to them by government.
Well, then why? But you have less accountability if the independent board isn't there. So there's actually not more accountability. It gives the premier more power. It does not create more levels of accountability for him because there's not that independent board that is overseeing what's happening and where this money's going. So it's very reminiscent, I feel, of like the 1980s Tory party, where it was really a party that really only cared about getting reelected. And they had slush funds and they had patronage. And this is how they built their reelection strategy. And it worked. They got, you know, three majority governments because they gave everybody money that asked for it. They put their friends in high places and controlled a lot of things. And I feel like this government is very reminiscent of the Tories of the 1980s, where there is the potential for these slush funds and patronage to happen at a large scale again. And I don't think that's a smart way to govern, particularly as we're heading into choppy, uncertain economic waters, very uncertain, you know, mid to long term economic environment where, you know, even the experts are trying to figure out exactly what's going to happen. So you want to make the best decisions and utilize the finite resources you have to have the biggest impact possible. And, you know, having less experts around the table and professionals in the field and having more partisan politics involved in that decision making, I don't see as being a smart way to do that.
Speaking of issues with major economic implications, you're obviously paying close attention to what's going on with power rates. Right now, Mr. Houston, publicly anyway, you can analyze what he's doing, whatever way you want, but he does seem to be taking a hard stand publicly against NSP and against the agreement that they just reached with lawyers for industrial customers and residential ratepayers. Obviously, nobody wants to pay 13-14% more power, but he's taking a stand. He's put in legislation that caps increases to a certain extent. What should he be doing that you would do?
So this is something that we've been pushing for, is to have an intervention to make sure that people aren't being harmed by, the power rates were going to go up, I think, over 20% at one point. That was what the request was, at a time when everything else is going up as well. So we really have been pushing for support for people during a period where rates are going up. I am concerned about how he's approaching it, though. I do think it makes more sense to provide support directly to individuals instead of intervening in the energy market in the way that he has. Because here's my concern on this. In order for us to have stable rates mid and long term, we've got to be more dependent on renewables and getting off of fossil fuels. You know, coal is super expensive right now. You know, still the majority of our power is derived from coal. And of course, there's the environmental concerns with that. Cape Breton just experienced major impacts of climate change with Hurricane Fiona. We're going to have more and more of these events.
We're also very much a coal-based community, though, although not as much as before, but it's still very much held high here in a lot of minds, the use of our coal.
Absolutely. And I mean, Donkin's going right now because the price of coal is so high. So when the price of coal is going up and the price of fossil fuels are shooting up, that is going to increase our rates, right? And I haven't seen a chart yet that suggests the price of these things are going to go down. In fact, they're going to keep increasing. So if we do want to have rate stability in Nova Scotia and lower power rates mid and long term, we really have to be moving towards more renewable sources of energy, again, for the climate, but also for our pocketbooks. And so the way that the premier has intervened with the rates on this one is really putting into jeopardy the renewable energy projects that Nova Scotia Power has and the public have been investing in. So this is one that we have to kind of watch and see what happens and adjust accordingly, because if we lose all these renewable energy projects, you know, we're not going to be doing our part to combat climate change, and we're going to see more and more destructive storms come through Nova Scotia, particularly as the waters continue to warm around our province. Like, that's been our protective shield to date from the hurricanes, like they get down south, is that we've had colder waters here. Those are starting to warm now. That's also going to impact lobster and fishery in Nova Scotia as well in a really, really potentially really consequential way. But we also have to get on these renewable resources to make power rates more affordable over the long run. And they just cut the cap and trade system that we had in Nova Scotia. So a carbon tax is coming to Nova Scotia now, and the Conservatives brought a bill in that eliminated the cap and trade system, which was negotiated previously, and that did our part to price carbon, but also protected consumers here in the province. So they've gotten rid of that, and now a carbon tax.
Federal requirements are getting more strict, though, aren't they? Didn't they basically have to get rid of that?
They didn't have to get rid of it. They could have expanded it. You know, we did need to have a bigger trade
to meet the more strict requirements. They could have still done that within the growing.
We believe so. Yeah, there's a growing cap and trade market. So California, we're part of a North American organization that included Quebec, California, among other jurisdictions. We had four Atlantic provinces also saying they didn't want a carbon tax. I think there would have been a great opportunity to negotiate with the Atlantic provinces to expand the cap and trade market that we're a part of now. And if you would have got the Atlantic provinces on and joined with Quebec, we think that you would have had the requirements necessary to meet the federal framework. But they didn't try that, right? So they scrapped cap and trade, and that means we're going to have the biggest increase to gas in the whole country come July. And we're going to be doing less for the environment here. So we're going to be in a position come July where Nova Scotians are paying more, for carbon pricing and doing less when it comes to the environment and investing in renewable energy. So that is not an optimal outcome, I don't think. For us, you know, you don't want to be in a position where you're spending more and doing less for the environment. But that is a situation that I think they've created by getting rid of our cap and trade system.
Part of this is obviously Ottawa's call at the end of the day, though, right? I mean, it's Guilbeault, the environment minister, and Ottawa that's making the call as to whether or not the Houston government's plan is satisfactory or not. So it's their decision.
Well, also the Supreme Court. So other provincial governments tried doing what the Houston government did and put forward a plan that did not have carbon pricing, but just said, you know, look at all that we're doing on the renewable side. And the Supreme Court also, you know, struck those plans down. So certainly the federal government is moving forward with carbon pricing. The question is, what carbon pricing model is best for Nova Scotia? The provincial Liberal Party has been of the opinion that cap and trade has been a preferable model for here because you price carbon, which we need to do. We collect money that is then redistributed to Nova Scotians for efficiency programming for their homes, for getting on electric vehicles. We put a lot of money back into the pockets of Nova Scotians, help them reduce their dependency on fossil fuels.
And now, there are rebates coming out from the federal level, and the province says it wants to have control over those rebates to do just what you've suggested there, give that money back to Nova Scotians. Do you think the province should have control over that money in rebates?
I mean, I think if we're going to pay a carbon tax in Nova Scotia, Nova Scotians are going to want that money back in their pocket directly.
And the province has been insisting that they get control over the money for those rebates, so I take it you'd be in favor of that?
Well, I don't know what they're going to do with it. You know, we actually have not seen a plan from the provincial government on that at all. So, I mean, it really depends on where those dollars are going and how they're going to be deployed and how Nova Scotians will benefit from it.
But in principle, do you think the province should have control over the money from those rebates?
I think that if Nova Scotians are paying directly for a carbon tax, they should get that money directly back in their pockets. So I don't think it would make sense for that money to then first go through the province. You know, they're paying a tax directly to Ottawa, they should get the rebate directly into their bank accounts. I don't know why Tim Houston would want to filter that and decide where that money goes when it should be going right back to Nova Scotians. Like, I don't think we should have been paying the carbon tax here. I think the cap and trade model is better because it protects consumers, particularly in rural Nova Scotia who have to travel to work. You know, we half our population lives rurally, and a lot of people live remotely. So all those people are going to be impacted more directly by a carbon tax. That's why the cap and trade was better, because it kept fuel price low, but also priced carbon and redistributed money from the big emitters. But under this system, I think if Nova Scotians are going to be paying a carbon tax, they should get that money right back. And I don't think it should go to the provincial government. I think it should go to them.
Okay. On that note, Zach, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, listen, it's always, always good talking to you, David. You're always a very, challenging interviewer, and I really appreciate that. You always have to be thoughtful when you come into your studio, and I love having this conversation with you. I do love visiting Cape Breton. This is the second time I've been here in 2 weeks. And, you know, as we head into winter, Cape Bretoners are still, you know, really excited for what can happen on this island. And I know that their energy is infectious to the rest of the province as well. So we're going to hopefully keep seeing people recover from Fiona. Hopefully we'll see the improvements that we need to see in our healthcare system. And hopefully with all this new economic control that Houston's acquiring for himself, he actually has a plan to help us get through these choppy economic waters, because there's a lot at stake for people.
Zach Churchill, thanks once again for being here, sir.
Thank you.
It's Christmas in Cape Breton like none other, coming up on December 19th at St. George's Church with Jordan Musician, also M. Dingwall, and Stephen Muse. It's my pleasure to welcome Jordan Musician to the program. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
It's going to be a great show. Remember last year?
Absolutely. Yeah, we sold it out last year, and we were excited about it. And unfortunately, that wave of COVID came in, but everything's looking great for this year.
Yeah, and tickets are available right now at the Curiosity Shop. And how many people are we looking here? 100, 125? Because the church is not that big.
No, it's like an intimate venue, which is kind of what we were looking for. Something just, you know, more of a storyteller kind of performance. But yeah, we're looking probably around 130 seats.
The sound in that church is going to be incredible.
Oh, the acoustics are amazing in there. Like we are going to have a sound set up, but like you almost don't need it. It's amazing.
So you got M. Dingwall and Stephen Muse.
It's going to be one big show. So basically, M is going to be playing bass and singing harmonies, and Stephen's going to be playing some piano and singing harmonies.
Okay, and you're going to be singing some stuff from your award-winning Christmas album there from a few years ago. That didn't you win at the East Coast Music Awards for that?
Yeah, I was very, very, very thrilled about that. We won an ECMA for it last year. Actually, we won it.
Yeah, a lot of work goes into something like that. So, when did you actually start doing a Christmas album?
We started recording the album on the hottest day of the summer in July 2019.
Wow. So you got to put yourself in that frame of mind. It's Christmas, and it worked because you won an ECMA for it.
We hung some Christmas lights around the studio and just put ourselves in the vibe, yeah.
What kind of songs will you be performing coming up for this event coming up on the 19th?
So I'm going to do a mix. I'm going to do most of the Christmas album, a bunch of originals. We got some covers on there. And then I'm going to go into some of the my older repertoire with playing some of my some other songs of mine.
So how long of a show are we talking here? An hour, hour and a half?
We're looking at coming on to 2 hours, probably an hour and a half, 2 hours, yeah.
That's nice, and a great price for the show as well. Tickets are only $20, and of course, this is a big fundraiser for St. George's Church, and they're so happy to have you on board to help them out. And again, limited supply of tickets, so if you're thinking about getting a ticket, I would do it today.
Absolutely. They're moving really quick already, so at the Cape Breton Curiosity Shop, you can pick them up.
All right, and if you can't get in, give them a shout at 564-4660, and again, it's coming up on December the 19th. That's a Monday, right?
It's a Monday night, yep.
Listen, thanks very much for chatting with us here, and good luck with the show, and a Merry Christmas.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m.
Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.